I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hello, listeners. How are you doing? Welcome back to the podcast. Great to be talking to you again. It's always good to be talking to the Lepsters on Luke's English Podcast. I hope you're doing well today. So let me tell you about this episode number. Is this number 743? I think it is. Okay, so let me tell you all about it. In this episode, I'm talking to author Natasha V. Broody, who has written a book which aims to help learners of English find the right tone in their speaking and writing. Tone is something which is very much affected by culture and often relates to things like being direct, indirect, formal, informal, and in English, things like the use of modal verbs and phrasal verbs and just generally the way you put things, like the way you ask for things, the way you give information, the way you present yourself in emails and stuff like that, whether it's all done in a certain way, you know, just different levels of politeness and formality, directness and indirectness, and so on. In English, the general tone is often quite friendly, but indirect and polite. And this can sometimes cause problems for English speakers coming from different places where codes of politeness or professionalism are different. And this does affect the way in which people construct their sentences, for example, making polite requests and things like that. Now, Natasha, the author of this book, has worked as an English teacher and also has worked in international contexts for the UN. And she has direct experience of observing people communicating in English and not quite getting the tone right. So in her book, which is called Give Me Tea, Please, Practical Ingredients for Tasteful Language, she lays out a sort of style guide with theory, practical tips, and a glossary of defined vocabulary at the back. And it sounds like an interesting book, which could be a worthwhile read for many of my listeners. So I thought it would be good to chat with Natasha a little bit and explore some of the ideas presented in her book. Give Me Tea, Please, Practical Ingredients for Tasteful Language, is currently available on Amazon. But from the 24th of September, so that's already happened, hasn't it, the 24th of September? So, in fact, now it's available from pretty much any place you can get books, I think, but certainly on Amazon, okay? So, anyway, Give Me Tea, Please. That's the book. Natasha V. Broody is the guest. She's the person who wrote it. So I will now let you sort of, like, you know, actually listen to the conversation. So let's meet Natasha Broody to find out some of those practical tips for tasteful language that are promised in her book. Okay, and I will talk to you a little bit more at the end of the episode, at the end of this conversation. But now let's get started with the conversation, and here we go.
Hello, we're talking about language.
Sit down, let's have a chat.
A bit of a chat, sir.
A bit of a chat, yes, Doctor, just a bit of a chat.
What about, sir?
About English as a global language.
This is a conversation.
Yes.
I would like to talk to you.
Okay, let's talk. Let's have a quick conversation, huh? What do you think?
That's what we're going to do.
Away, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a
conversation
about language.
Hello, Natasha. Hi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Luke, for having me.
It's a pleasure. How's your day going so far?
It just started. I'm in the States. I'm on the west coast of the States. Got to get my mind around geography. So yeah. It's early in the morning. It's around 9 a.m. I literally just woke up maybe half an hour to get ready for this interview. So my day is just starting.
Have you had coffee yet?
Nothing. I usually have my tea and I don't have it yet, but I will.
Wow. So it's a pre-tea podcast.
It is. Dear Lord God, what's going to come?
I know. The things you have to do to promote your work. Really.
Exactly.
Well, it's very nice to be speaking to you. Now, I'm going to ask you about your book in this conversation, but I thought that before I do that, it might be nice to get to know you a little bit beforehand. So, you know, can you tell us a few things about yourself? Like, you know, basically, where are you from? Where are you based now? What do you do? You know, the usual.
I'll try to make it brief. I was originally born in Texas and grew up in Florida, where I am right now. And that journey took me to New York, where in 2012, I started working for the British government for the United Nations. And working within the UN system allowed me to explore and expand with the United Nations Development Program and also with UNESCO. My latest job being this year where I worked as a communications consultant on the Freedom of Expression Unit. So from right before I had that last job earlier this year, in pre-COVID time, around 2017, I started to take a new direction with my career to focus on language acquisition, to learn languages. And that was Russian, Spanish, French, and German. That was the goal. And the goal from that would be to begin using those language skills as a humanitarian officer, ideally within Senegal. So that was the major plan pre-COVID.
Wow. That's one hell of a plan.
It sounds extreme. I had it all worked out. I was living in Moscow for about 2 years, or maybe a little shy of 2 years. And then I've switched into Paris, where I was living for 2 years as well, and really just trying to improve my language skills. COVID happened, like it did for everyone else. And so I ended up cutting my trip short to return back to the US.
How many languages was it that you were hoping to learn?
Four. I was hoping to learn four languages. A bit ambitious, I know, but that's the way I roll. Did I learn all four languages? Absolutely not. And do I speak these languages fluently? Absolutely not. But the goal, I think, as we know as language learners, is to begin speaking and using the language as much as possible. And that is why I chose to move to the regions of my target language to have 24/7 access to listening, reading, speaking, and writing the language on a day-to-day basis.
What was your approach to learning the languages?
The approach that I am still using that I think is the best approach. Let me rephrase that. I think is the best approach depending on how you learn. This is the most important aspect, I think, when you're doing a language. I'm a very kinesthetic learner. And that means for the language learners here, the English language learners here, that I need to be physically involved with whatever kind of new left brain or right brain concept that I want to learn. I have to touch it. I have to see it. I have to work in it. I have to speak it. I have to be physically involved. So once I understood that about how I learned, what I began to do is I began to do a lot of building very simple sentences. One subject, one verb, one object. And learning how to write grammatically accurately simple sentences allowed me to have quite a large sentence vocabulary for each of the languages, for Russian and for French. Those were the two that I got in. And I have a previous background in Spanish, so that's the reason that one was kind of last on the table. But by approaching it that way, I was able to begin building up, you know, maybe around a pre-intermediate level, speaking level. Mm-hmm. And I realized that if I took that approach and began working with really friends, finding a language speaking community, I could find ways to begin exercising verbally my one sentence, one subject, one verb, one object approach. It's helped a lot. The parts where I suffer the most, especially with French, not so much Russian, I think, is the accent and the pronunciation. It's just very difficult for me to speak it accurately and not sound like an idiot while I'm speaking, but it's quite fun. I actually find it fun, so it's not so bad. But I would say that approach has helped me the most to live in these countries for, you know, a couple of years and survive.
Which one is more difficult to pronounce? Is it Russian or French?
Honestly, I think it's French. But that could be because when I was in New York working for British government at the UN, I was also doing language training in Russian. So I had a good three, maybe even 4 years prior to my arrival in Russia, just learning how to pronounce these words. Those 3 to 4 years were difficult. It took me 2 years to learn how to say "Здравствуйте," which is hello in Russian. 2 years to just say it where a Russian would understand what it is that I've said. But again, it's like the practice, the constant repetition to retrain and reprogram the muscles in your mouth to move and to pronounce the language in a way that could be understood. So I think at this stage, it's French.
Yes. Yes. Okay. All right. So your project, yes, to learn four languages and then ultimately to work in humanitarian aid
Dakar, Senegal.
Right. Okay. But then COVID happened. So did you actually manage to get out there to Senegal?
No, I didn't. I have not lost that aspiration. I think when this COVID nightmare is over, I'm probably going to pick it up and just go straight down there. Since I've been practicing French for a little bit now. But no, COVID has really flipped the world, hasn't it? So no, not yet.
So how did the book come into it then?
So living in the regions of my target language, I did, I taught English. I taught business English to professionals. And while I was teaching them, I realized that there were really critical mistakes that they were making in their professional English communication skills and correspondence. So I began like writing notes and then giving verbal advice to, you know, kind of tweak and to correct not just the grammar, but the tone and the way that the language was coming out. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, if I keep doing this verbally, you know, I might as well just write a book. Why not write a book? So I started my book, Give Me Tea, Please, in 2018. And I was in Russia at that time. And I had maybe probably the first half of the book written by the time I had moved on to Paris and France. What I was realizing and what I was seeing was that my clients were quite engaged in the way that I wrote. They found it clear. They found it they could understand it, la, 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 la. So I decided to kind of structure this book in a way that I hadn't seen from the business English books I was given to use and began finding online, just structuring it in a way that seemed completely different, which I can get into a little bit later, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So that is pretty much how the book started to form. But I didn't finish the book. Again, COVID just sucked the life out of some energy for some projects. So when I got back to the States, I decided to take it quite seriously and to finish it, publish it, and, you know, tell my clients about it and tell others about it, that it's done and it's an available resource.
Okay. So the book is called Give Me Tea, Please.
Yes.
Right. Now, could you explain the title of the book and perhaps tell us the story which is attached to it?
Yes, indeed. So the book title is called Give Me Tea, Please. Subtitle, Practical Ingredients for Tasteful Language. And the title really came about due to my experience, my first few, I think it's fair to say months in Moscow, where I was trying again to just use the language immediately and speak very small, short, simple sentences. My accent was still pretty bad. And so I was trying to order tea, really cautious about trying to be polite. And in response, the Russian community was really, really patient, especially in the service community. And so I would always get stopped like, I don't know what you're saying. Like there would always be these kind of strange, like, I really don't know what you're saying. And yeah. So one time a woman had told me she speaks English when I was ordering tea. And so I said, oh, well, how do I do this? How do I order tea in Russian? And she said, you can just say, "Дайте чай, пожалуйста." That's fine. Everyone understands it. It's perfectly fine. You won't get chocolate milk if you said something like that. So I began using that phrase, translating the phrase, and really thinking about it. The direct translation for that phrase is, "Give me tea, please." Now, you and I as native English speakers know that if you were to walk up to any service professional, any person even, and say, "Give me tea, please," even your friends, it is still very abrupt. The intonation behind these words are too abrupt. And yeah. I wanted to be able to find a more polite way to do it. I figured, oh, maybe she thinks, oh, she's learning, she's a foreigner, let's just give her the very basics so she can communicate. Mm-hmm. So I researched the polite version, which I thought would be I would like to have tea, please. Something around like that. Yeah. Again, my accent, very bad. It might even still be a little weird. So I'm thinking that I've learned, you know, the polite version. I'm thinking that I've nailed it. I go back into, you know, restaurants and cafes, and I try using this polite version. And again, the blank stares of, "Miss, I have no idea what you're saying." So I would switch into the simple form that I was taught, you know, "Дайте чай, пожалуйста." And then I would always get my tea. So that's really how the title came about. This "Give me tea, please." It's too abrupt for the etiquette in English standards, but in other languages, it may be perfectly fine. So how do you translate tone when tone is not necessarily a written language?
Yes, absolutely. There's so much packed into the difference between "Give me tea, please," and "I would like some tea."
Yes.
So much packed into that. I mean, I've heard of theories about things like high and low context cultures, and that may have something to do with it. But certainly the thing about saying "I would like some tea" is that it's not a request and it's not a question.
Exactly.
It's just a statement of like, I would like some tea. And you expect the other person to interpret what that means, which exactly. basically means "I would like some tea" means, "Can you give me some tea, please?" And so I guess in some cultures that's indirect and kind of stupid. It's like, if you want tea, just ask for tea.
Exactly.
So you say, "Give me tea, please." You said "please." That's polite, isn't it? What more do you want?
Exactly. Yeah? Exactly that.
Okay. Okay. So in investigating this thing about, you know, how do I actually politely ask for tea, you kind of uncovered this kind of cultural difference in terms of tone and how it's used in different languages and stuff like that. And so as a teacher of English or a trainer in, you know, for people learning English, has that come into your teaching a lot then, talking about tone and the importance of getting it right?
Yeah, I think so. Not so much teaching, for example, like body language and the tone that comes off with body language, not so much that. I think what usually kind of transpires in the business English courses I've taught in the past is it's really a system. It's finding a system designed specifically for each client, each person who is learning business English, finding a system that works well with the English that they know already. So even if they have a low level of English, sometimes it's around A2, like an upper elementary kind of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Or if they're fully advanced, based on how your culture it expresses language in terms of commands and professional communication, how do we change that to ensure that for English communication, working national clients across the globe, how do we ensure that you're always going to be communicating not only what you want or you need to provide, but to do it in a way that will not cause offense or will not raise an eyebrow, or especially with written language where you can't hear tone, how do you ensure that it is visibly professional? So that would be the more of the target. And then working within that framework, we look at the differences between what's the impact of using phrasal verbs versus using using a phrase or expression that is more formal. As we know, phrasal verbs are used for more informal language, and then you have verbs that you find more in professional communication. How do we ensure that when we're making requests or demands of others, that we always are presented in a way that shows politeness? Well, we have modals that will help us with that. So you can really focus on using polite modals, and it will give you an extra added bonus to present yourself as professionally as possible. So I would say that would be the framework and the structure that I would usually use with my clients.
Mm-hmm. How do people know then? How do we know what the right tone is? You know, because a Russian person, let's say coming to London, as I've seen many times actually, because I used to live there and work there, and I would take my students to the pub and stuff, and it would be like one beer, please, or even just one Guinness.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even the full. You know, no please or anything. Just one Guinness,
yeah,
one beer.
Yeah.
So how do, and you know, obviously it should be, excuse me, can I have a pint of Guinness, please? You know, that's what it should be. But how do people know then what the right tone is and what, you know, what sort of language codes they should be
using? It's a fair question, especially if you're in a region of the world where, I mean, you can hear this podcast, but you might not be able to travel outside of your country. I've heard it many times. How would you be able to know? I say a lot of it is informed by your own culture. I don't think there are rude cultures out there in a sense, per se. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that is already informed by your own cultural practices, whether you don't practice being polite on a day-to-day basis or whether you do practice being polite on a day-to-day basis. For my book, focusing specifically for just communicating in business environments, what I did was in the second part of the book, well, let me explain it from the first. Like I said earlier before, I was very conscientious about how I wrote this book. The first part, part one, is all about theories. It's about the theoretical construction behind formal, informal, polite, and impolite language. The second part of the book takes those theories and puts them into practice. I did that by essentially stating that there are three basic forms of communication. When you want something, when you have to communicate or provide information, and when you have to deal with very serious matters like contracts or money matters. So based on those three basic types of communication, I went into depth about when you want something, you should be formal and indirect if possible. When you want to provide information, use a mixture of formal language and direct and indirect language, a mixture of it. When you're doing contract matters, my suggestion is to be formal and direct. And I find that the language, the tonal aspect that is the most difficult to understand is what is professional direct language. So I really take time in the book to suss out these questions and to write it and to present the information in a way that is simple, practical, and very highly structured, so you can follow along and write your own notes about how you communicate and how you can pull these suggestions into your communication style.
That's great. And certainly in English, for people who are out there learning English and wondering of all the different codes, I mean, we talk of formal and informal and neutral and so on. I would say for most everyday business and or professional communication. It's going to be a sort of neutral style, which kind of borrows bits of the indirectness and from formal language and bits of the friendliness from informal language. And it sort of like rides the line, that sort of neutral tone. But within that, you're going to get the polite requests and you're going to get the politeness is built in. So, I mean, you know, there aren't that many different versions. It's basically this kind of standard professional politeness, which you can, you know, learn from lots of those business English books and so on.
Exactly.
But it's a question of just like trying to think within that language framework and trying to, I think a lot of people coming from different language contexts will feel uncomfortable being as almost apologetic and indirect as we all are in English. I mean, my wife is French, and sometimes she doesn't understand. Like, her English is very good, but she doesn't realize, or it doesn't come naturally to her, to be as indirect as I might be, you know, when dealing with, I don't know, people in the service situation in England. So it's just a question of like trying to, you know, keep that in mind, that you're kind of thinking in another way, as well as using different words.
I can raise a point to that applies to both my experience in France and in Russia. I had this French client who I just adored him. He had this desire to write these very long, poetically constructed kind of emails for business communication. I mean, these were beautiful. You could like put these emails on display for, you know, a poetry reading. It was very intricate with all these different attempts to be complex in the sentence structure. But his speaking level and his written level was really only at an intermediate level. So there were so many grammar errors that he was missing that was making the comprehension behind what he was trying to do lost. And it would be really simple things, for example, like stating that, you know, all colleagues should on Friday, you know, go to the X room of the office for a meeting. Something very simple, but his email constructions were like, I don't know. I would think maybe I always have this trick with my intermediate level clients where I ask them to count the number of words in their sentence after they write them. And his sentences would have like 20 to 30 words just to ask or communicate something very simple. So I remember learning and being in French culture that, you know, within French culture, it is part of the culture to use language as beautifully as possible. I mean, French is a beautiful language. So I could see how the translation from French into English was losing meaning. And then I would have to work with him to shorten up the sentences and to become more specific and at times more direct. So he would be able to get what he wants from a native English speaker or from a speaker of English at the C1, C2 level and not lose his meaning and communication within these emails. So that's one example of where too much indirectness and too much language, it was just not working. On the flip side of that, in Russia, I had this one client who was phenomenal. She did everything I taught her and told her, and her English level just soared within months. When we got to this lesson about using structuring an email when you I think it's when you want something that this was, it was either when you want something or when you need to provide information. But I think this one for her was when you want something. I had taught her this lesson that I present in the book about how to obtain better results when you want something by using modals and some etiquette practices in emails. And one of the major lines that I'm sure you might agree with would be, when you're structuring a professional email, you don't just go straight into what you want. You usually say hi, or I hope this email finds you well, or it was great seeing you last Tuesday. Something that's, you know, positive and kind of starts the conversation. Mm-hmm. my Russian client, she pretty much was saying what you had said before, where she was like, why? What is this for? We're doing business. Come on. What is this whole, this is crazy. But she came back to me the next week that I had taught her this, and the smile on her face, she was like, Tasha, like I wrote something really kind first, and then I just kind of went into my email, and the response that I got, it seemed happy. And I was just laughing because it's true. The tonality just changes when you're trying to communicate with someone, specifically in English, by using more kind of polite language or more soft language or more indirect ways. So that's two ways how you can see communication either being lost or communication enhancing when you try to, you know, follow if you're working within an English speaking environment, or you have to use English as the means for communication when you align to etiquette practices that we use as native English speakers, you might find some improvement in the way that you are received.
You go into details about different types of sentence, right? I mean, you've got your four tonal categories and stuff like that. And then there's details of the different, you talk about a simple sentence, a compound sentence, and a complex sentence. Yes. So can you tell us about that? And does this relate to like choosing the right tone as well?
Yes. So where in the theoretical section, part one, for each of the four tonal categories, I break it down, or at least I hope I've broken it down quite clearly as to what makes X type of communication formal or informal or direct or indirect. And at the end of each of those sections, I have a language review that will pull different grammatical terms that language learners may or may not know, so that they have better understanding of what I was referring to in the previous sentences above. So when I have simple sentence, compound sentence, complex sentence, essentially there were sections within the formal category where I was discussing formal category, where I was suggesting to non-native English speakers who may not have a full grasp on the English language, who may be, you know, the low intermediate level or maybe upper beginning levels, and they want to still use English communication for work, for advancement or for whatever. So I break it down by saying, well, if this applies to you, use a simple sentence format where you have one subject, one verb, or one object, and one object. And that should be able to, at the very least, provide basic communication, basic understanding to the person that you're speaking to. I suggested for the same group, as well as those who are fully in the intermediate level, maybe even upper intermediate, if you still are receiving, you know, the raised eyebrows or the question marks in your email, or I still don't understand your communication, this type of thing, if you're still receiving that response, however, you're also receiving acknowledgement that you're being clear, go ahead and try doing compound sentences, because a compound sentence essentially is just taking one simple sentence, using some type of conjunction like the word and or but, and then taking another simple sentence and putting it at the end. There you have your compound sentence. So you can begin to improve and to challenge yourself by lengthening your sentences so it doesn't feel so robotic or perfunctory. And then for the last part where I spoke about complex sentences, essentially I was saying if you're an upper intermediate speaker or you're at the C1, C2 level, go ahead and improve your language and communication by using a complex sentence. And at that time, they usually know what a complex sentence is, where you have a simple sentence that's attached to usually some type of coordinating conjunction in order to make longer sentences, show comparisons and contrast, and really kind of add some, you know, eloquence to the way that you speak.
Also, at the back of your book, you have a sort of a glossary, don't you, of defined terms? Because as you're reading the book, some of the terms are in bold. And then if you flip to the back, you find those words defined and stuff. It's like a mini dictionary.
I do indeed. Cool. Again, one of the things that I saw missing from... I was really hoping to make this book quite a unique and enjoyable experience. At first, I said that, you know, it's broken into two parts. One is theoretical, one is practical. I haven't really seen that in business English textbooks. The second aspect highlights what you've just said, words in bold. So since this is an ebook, you have words that are presented in bold type, in bold typeface. And each of these words are words that I have seen used quite regularly in professional communication and even day-to-day communication. So my belief is that it should become part of every non-native English speaker's vocabulary, especially if you're in professional communication, using words like, oh God, I put myself on the spot here, trying to think of a professional word.
Differences between like despite and in spite of and the other useful linking words.
Example. So instead of saying although and even though, which are pretty informal and used really for verbal communication, you would use the word despite or in spite of, which in spite of is usually seen as little less formal than the word despite. That's a perfect example. Thanks, Luke. So yes, we can go on something like that.
But the thing about that is that there's like different grammar to them, right? So although and despite them have the same role, but they fit into sentences differently. So there's different structure involved. So I guess your glossary at the back is going to be a useful way to build.
I hope so. I really do.
Yeah. Okay. So where can people actually get a copy of the book if they want to?
So at the moment, it's exclusively on Amazon for, I think, 10 more days or maybe 9. On September 24th, that is when it will be launched on all platforms. I'm even trying to establish some way where when someone has my website, lifewithabige.com, if you go to my website, you would be able to buy it directly from there. So September 24th is when it expands to everywhere, every platform that I can possibly have it distributed on.
Okay. So Give Me Tea, Please by Natasha V. Broody. You know what? Just before you go, I just wanted to ask you about your accent, because we're always interested in accents and stuff on this podcast. And so you're from the States. You said you were sort of born in Texas originally and have lived in different parts of the country. But I don't know. I don't feel like you have a really strong sort of standard American accent. And in fact, sometimes it almost sounds a bit English. Have people ever commented on your accent?
I get comments on it all the time. Favorable comments and very insulting comments. I'm actually British and English. American and British. But I wasn't raised in Britain. I've worked for British government for years. My family is in Britain. Part of my family is in Britain. I spend a lot of my time in an international community, which strangely enough does not usually have many Americans, probably because of the nature of the UN and how it works and how it's structured. But Russia and France aren't the only two countries that I've lived in. I've lived in New Zealand. I know that has had an impact on the way that I speak. Russia, I've lived in France. I've spent some time in Ghana. It's at least 23 countries that I've either traveled to or have lived in for a long period of time. So for me, I know it's weird because I cannot hear. I just hear me. But sometimes when I'm listening to something that's been recorded like this, I'll hear kind of like an English drawl, and it will put me back when I was working with the British government or recently. I think it was last year, one of my best friends had said, that sounds French. And he was referring to the way I had said professor. Apparently I was like, professor, or something like that, which had made sense because I was practicing this word so many times to get that kind of thing from France. So now my accent is just a mixed accent where it's just from everything, I think. Every place I've lived, every language that I practice, especially with the accent, there's American in it. There will always be my American in it, but it's probably no longer purely American.
Yeah, so you sound American, and then sometimes you'll say something, and it's like, whoa, you've got an English accent. So the way you say British, for example, you sound like you're from London. British.
I honestly don't know. I just speak. I literally just speak. Lord knows what it's going to sound like by the time I obtain my four languages.
Or we are the sort of, you know, we are the sum, or the our accent is the sum of all of our experiences, isn't it, really, I suppose, and all the communities that we accommodate to and all that sort of thing. So every person's accent tells a story.
It does indeed. I agree with that very much.
Okay. Right. Well, Natasha, thank you very much for talking to us. Good luck
thank
with the book.
You.
I wonder if any of my listeners will be going out to grab
I
a copy.
So.
Yes, I think it would be a good idea. Okay, well, listeners, if you do get the book and you enjoy reading it, then why not leave a review on Amazon? That always
Indeed.
Helps.
Thank you very
that would
much.
Be a nice
Please
thing.
Leave the reviews.
They're essential,
thank
aren't
you
they?
Very much. Yeah. Luke, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. This was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay, well, have a lovely day. You can have tea
I
now.
I can indeed. I'll make my pot of tea.
So that was Natasha V. Broody talking about her book, Give Me Tea, Please. Practical Tips for Tasteful Language. It's available from all good bookstores. So go ahead and pick up a copy and a coffee. I nearly said coffee. Go ahead and pick up a coffee and a copy of the book. And if you like it, I mean, if you like the book, then you can leave a review on Amazon. And if you like the coffee, you can leave a review for that too somewhere. But anyway, if you fancy it, get a copy of the book. And if you like it, leave a nice review. That would be very helpful. Thanks again to Natasha for her contribution in this episode. Listeners, I seriously hope that you found this interesting and stimulating and all those other good things. If you've got comments, you know, if you've got thoughts in your head, do you have thoughts in your head? I hope so. Maybe thoughts like, oh, I'd like some cake. I don't know what thoughts you have in your head. Maybe thoughts relating to the conversation that you heard in this episode. Feel free to leave them in the comments section. That would be very good. Either on my website, teacherluke.co.uk, and find the page for this episode and leave your comment there. Or do it on YouTube if you're listening on YouTube. Hello, YouTube people. Hello, website people. Hello, podcast people. It's all good in Lepland. So that's kind of the end of this episode. I thought that I would have a short ramble at the end, okay, and then also play a song at the end. So a bit of sort of, you know, rambling and song stuff, you know, the usual ingredients for an episode of Luke's English Podcast. So let's have the short ramble. So, well, you know, what's going on in Lepland? Obviously the t-shirts and merchandise thing, that's kind of a big deal. As you may have heard in the previous episode, I've launched my merch store. And so you can get yourself various t-shirts and mugs and pads and stickers and other things. Tote bags and like water jugs and stuff, all kinds of things, with different types of Luke's English Podcast designs on them, all done by my brother. New ones, like funky new designs, made by James. And so go ahead and check them out if you haven't already done so. teacherluke.co.uk/merch. And if you're in the world, right, if you're in the world, probably use the TeePublic store. But if you are also in the world, but you're in Russia or China, TeePublic doesn't send to those countries for some reason. I don't know why. Fear not, because Russia and China, you can use the Redbubble store. And the red part is just a coincidence. Okay, that's, you know, just a pure coincidence. But Redbubble do ship to Russia and China. Why do we say ship, right? Is it always, you know, when, you know, your product, your, you know, your thing has been shipped, like Amazon will send you an email, like, you know, you buy a book, your book has been shipped. Is it really been shipped? It's funny that, like, sometimes it's just, you know, being taken by car or something, but they still say that it's been shipped. It sounds quite cool though as well, doesn't it? You know, if you buy a t-shirt from the Luke's English Podcast merch stores, then you will get an email, one of those cool emails saying your order has been shipped. Oh, yes. It might not have even been transported by ship, but anyway. What was I talking about? all the different designs. There are some cool designs. There's a Luke's English Podcast Ninja design. There are different sort of versions of the Luke's English Podcast logo. There's a Rick Thompson Report one. There's all sorts of cool stuff. Check them out. Okay? All right. And also, there's a sale on the Tee Public store, which lasts maybe a couple of weeks. So you can, because the store's new, there's a sale, so you can get some pretty nice discounts. So check it out. And don't forget the design competition, the Luke's English Podcast Design Competition 2021. I decided to put the year at the end, 2021, because it makes it sound a lot more serious and established, almost like it's sort of like the Olympics or something. If you put the year at the end of competition, it just sounds much better. If it was like just the Luke's English Podcast Design Competition, fine. But the Luke's English Podcast Design Competition 2021 makes it sound like an annual sort of like awards ceremony. I don't know. Anyway, the design competition. Yes, if you want to get one of your designs on a Luke's English Podcast t-shirt or mug or whatever, then go ahead and send me your designs. podcastcomp@gmail.com. Okay, that's where you can send your designs. And I want, what is it? Aim for about 300 DPI. So the sort of, the designers will know what that means, but we're looking for something with, you know, a large number of pixels, please, because it's got to go on t-shirts and stuff. So about 300 DPI. If you go back to the page for episode 742, if you want other specifications, and you've got until 22nd of October to send me your design. And we'll collect the designs. I wonder how many people are going to send things in. It's quite a specific one, isn't it, this? It's quite a challenging one. But don't forget, not only will you get your design, if you win, you'll get your design in the store, in both stores, but also you will win £80. That's right, an £80 cash prize. Serious stuff, this competition. £80 cash prize. So go to the page for episode 742 for other details, like technical specs about the designs and the images and things. But you've got until the 22nd of October. It's completely up to you to decide what kind of design you think would be appropriate. Remember, we are sort of looking for Luke's English Podcast Ninjas, maybe Dissecting the Frog, something like that. You know, the sort of... the catchphrases and things that often are said on the podcast. Those are some ideas for you. So there you go. It's actually quite chilly. I'm actually quite cold. It's September and sort of things have taken a slightly chilly turn. So it's a little on the cold side. Anyway, Luke's English Podcast Premium. Hello, premium listeners. Hello, good people of Luke's English Podcast Premium. I've got new premium content coming. Okay, including the conclusion of series 31. What did Jill say? And also, I'm going to move into the more story focused stuff. I think I've been trying to collect as many stories as I can, and I'm looking at that. I'm also looking at ideas around the idea of the text detectives, which is an idea I've had for ages. And text detectives, this is basically about going into just random texts, articles, and, you know, newspaper texts and things like that, email newsletters or adverts that you see online or any kind of text, going into it and exploring it for English and breaking it all down and learning lots of English from it. So story things are on my mind, text detectives, the usual kinds of breaking down conversations and stuff like that. More premium content will be coming. But thank you for your support, premium listeners. You keep the whole ship, the good ship LEP, afloat. You really, really do. And so there you go. Check out also, you know, obviously my YouTube channel is still active and stuff. I post all my episodes onto YouTube, and that's a place where people comment and things, and you can get the automatic subtitles, which are often quite accurate. So you could, you know, make sure you subscribe on YouTube. Don't forget to smash that like button, okay, guys? So there you go. All right. I'm on about 200,000 subscribers on YouTube now. It was only a few months ago that I was at 100,000 and I got my YouTube shiny thing and stuff. And already, bam, we're at 200,000. We doubled it already in quite a short period of time. It's crazy, this whole online world. It really is. All the different platforms and the things you've got to sort of do to manage them and stuff. It really is a sort of, it's like a computer game. It's kind of how I see it. It really is like the whole thing is like a big computer game, and you've got to just, it's like one of those management simulators, and it's sort of doing the right things at the right time. And it's weird. The gamification of everything. It's an odd time in which we sort of ride the algorithms, you know, and trying to sort of flirt with the algorithms and get and you know, riding waves. It's like surfing. Surfing the internet. There you go. We've come full circle. Do you remember that when we used to talk about surfing the internet? What are you going to do this afternoon? That used to be a hobby. I remember when I was, you know, when I used to teach English, I obviously still do, but I used to as well. Anyway, when I taught English in the old days, I'm talking about sort of the early days of my career when the internet hadn't fully become the monster that it is today. There would always be, you know, the usual lessons about what are your hobbies? Although that's never a question that people actually ask each other. It's always in English lessons, but we never actually use it in the real world. What are your hobbies? But that was always one of the, it was like, you know, reading, whatever, playing football, surfing the internet was like a hobby that you could have back in the early noughties. Surfing the internet could be a hobby. You'd log in, wouldn't you? You'd log into the internet, connect to the World Wide Web. What was that noise that it would make? Hold on a minute. Is that an analog internet connection noise, he says, typing into YouTube? Dial-up internet. Do you remember this? Hold on. The days when you had to do this to get online. Oh, there you go. The sounds of the internet. Those were the days when you had to dial up, you know, to actually get online. And then you would surf the World Wide Web. Oh, those were the days. Oh, good times. Anyway, so much simpler in those days, it seems. So here we are, pretty much at the end of the episode. I thought that I would sing a song for you because it's been too long and I like to do this on the podcast. And it seems that most people don't mind, except for the very occasional one-star iTunes review. I'm going to sneeze. Oh, my goodness. That was an explosive sneeze that came from nowhere. That almost rivals my brother's powerful sneezes on the podcast. I do apologise. I have to sincerely apologise now, don't I, for sneezing. Any time that the body malfunctions when you're doing a podcast requires very sincere apologies from the wrongdoer. So I do apologise sincerely for my body exploding in such an impolite fashion. So please forgive me, Lepsters. I didn't mean to do that. I mean, obviously, I could edit it out, but somehow that seems less funny. I don't know why. Anyway. Oh, there's something good about a good sneeze, though, isn't there? Oh, you know what I mean? Did I read Once Upon a Time? We're in Tangent City here, okay? We've taken a trip to Tangent Town. So, did I read Once Upon a Time? This is a weird tangent. That a sneeze is actually an eighth of an orgasm. Hold on. Is a sneeze an eighth, E-I-G-H-T-H, of an orgasm? Okay, now maybe I'm insane and I'm the only person in the world who thinks that a sneeze is an eighth of an orgasm, or someone once said this, or I'm imagining it. I'm imagining it and I'm completely insane. Let's find out. Googling. Is a sneeze... Okay, I'm not the only person. Medium.com. Is a sneeze really an eighth of an orgasm? Oh, hold on. Hold on a minute. Sorry about that, listeners. Sorry about that little interruption. That's the word I'm looking for. Sorry about the interruption. I had to rush downstairs because my lunch was delivered. I'm slightly out of breath from running around. I ran down the stairs to try and greet the guy in the staircase. So, yes, my lunch was delivered. I ordered a Deliveroo. Deliveroo is a company that delivers lunch to you, basically, or dinner. I cheated today and I just ordered a Deliveroo instead of cooking for myself. I'm too lazy to do it for myself today. So I thought, right, I'll order a Deliveroo. Anyway, where was I? This is full on Tangent City here. Tangent Town in Texas. Right, so is a sneeze really an eighth of an orgasm? Well, let's see. This is what it says. The amount of endorphins produced by a sneeze. That's endorphins, that's not dolphins, okay? Imagine if every time you sneeze, dolphins were created. Like, this is how dolphins exist. Just every time a human sneezes, bam, more dolphins. No, it's endorphins. These are things, sort of, I don't know what, like chemicals in your brain that give you pleasure and stuff. The amount of endorphins produced by a sneeze is far less than an orgasm, and there is no cumulative effect with sneezing. There's no snow involved. So no amount of sneezing is going to feel like an orgasm. Both sneezes and orgasms are involuntary reflexes that feel good and involve erectile tissue. What? Sorry? Erectile tissue? How does sneezing involve erectile tissue? Do you know what erectile tissue is, listeners? Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure I know, actually. I'm not going to Google erectile tissue. Oh, my God, listeners, I'm so sorry. How did we get here? I'm really sorry about this. This is so weird. We started with this nice conversation, a good professional and polite, proper conversation about a decent topic. And then I say at the end, OK, I'll have a little ramble. And then here we are, erectile tissue. but you know, let's go with it, I suppose. Okay, let's see what medium.com says. According to the popular rumor debunking site Snopes.com is a great website. They debunk rumors and myths. This sexual fable started sometime in the mid-90s. The confusion may have originated with American sex therapist Dr. Ruth, who's been quoted as saying, an orgasm is just a reflex like a sneeze. Her statement, when diluted and taken out of context, could be misconstrued as an orgasm is just like a sneeze. But it's a myth, blah, 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 blah. Where's the erectile tissue? Sorry, but you know what I mean, listeners, right? I mean, let's cut to the chase. This is what we want to know about. The myth might also have its origins in the fact that both the inside of the nose and the genital area contain erectile tissue. You what? Now, obviously, the genital area, certainly in a man, I knew contained erectile tissue, right? Because an erection, you know what an erection is, listeners? That's when a man is sort of proud and excited at the same time. Oh, dear. Anyway, erection, right? An erectile tissue is, I suppose, tissue is like skin and stuff that becomes erect. But apparently, the inside of the nose and the genital area contain erectile tissue. What kind of erectile tissue have you got in your nose? So, if you're feeling a bit sort of, if you're feeling a bit horny, like start sneezing. What's going on? I don't know. This doesn't make any sense. However, this is the sort of thing I could do in text detectives. You see? See, it's a good idea, isn't it? I must do this sort of thing, like going through a text and all that stuff. So, however, there is no scientific evidence to support the idea that erectile tissues from different parts of the body operate in the same way. The ear also contains erectile tissue. And unless you're listening to Beyoncé, there's nothing to suggest such a thing as an eargasm exists. What the hell is going on in this article? Erectile tissue in your ear? The specific fractional amount of an orgasm supposedly felt when one sneezes is not a definite number. As a kid, I was told an eighth, But while disproving a similar myth, Women's Health magazine suggests the figure is one-tenth. Business Insider Australia, who also investigated the claim, interpreted the idea as sneezing 6 or 7 times in a row. Regardless, it's clear the number was never rooted in fact and is most likely one of those inane statistics people throw out confidently at parties to prove a point. So basically, it's bollocks. It's not true, except that somehow there is erectile tissue in your nose and your ears, which I don't understand, and that that's involved in sneezing, and also an orgasm obviously involves erectile tissue. So, rather unsatisfying conclusion, but apparently they are just sort of, what's the word for it, reactions, involuntary reactions of the body. And that maybe something about having an involuntary reaction like that, there's something pleasurable about losing control for that moment, but they are not the same. And it's and it doesn't matter how many sneezes you have in a row, they don't add up. And so there we go. All right, good. I'm very glad we cleared that up. That was obviously very important that we sorted that out and that now we can move on. I've no idea how we got to this. I'll be completely honest. Here we are talking about all these weird things. I cannot remember how we ended up talking about... That's it, because I sneezed. Because I sneezed violently. I don't know if I was going to talk about something else, but I sneezed violently. Anyway, it's time to finish, and I'm going to play a song for you, because I haven't played songs on the podcast for a while, and I like to do that. And that's it. Some people like it, except every now and then I get the occasional one-star review on iTunes by someone who says, you know, please do not sing a song on the podcast. So if that is you, then you can stop listening now, and you've been listening to Luke's English Podcast. You can imagine the jingle has happened. If you're happy to listen to me sing, stick around. And I'm going to go bye, 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 right? And then you'll hear the song, and then there'll be the jingle at the end, just so you know what's going on. Okay, so thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. It was a pleasure to talk to Natasha as well. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and I will speak to you again soon. But for now, it's just time to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. So the song I'm going to play for you is actually by Coldplay. Coldplay, they're not my favourite band or anything. They're okay. I actually preferred their earliest stuff, the first couple of songs that they ever came out with. I remember hearing them on the radio quite a lot. And so I'm going to play one of those ones. It's called Trouble. And I think that I will let the song speak for itself. So this is Trouble by Coldplay. Spider web is tangled up with me, and I lost my head. And thought of all the stupid things I'd said. And oh no, what's this? Spiderweb, and I'm caught in the middle. So I turned to run, and thought of all the stupid things I'd done. And I never meant to cause you trouble. I never meant to do you wrong. Ah, well, if I ever caused you trouble, then oh no, I never meant to do you harm. And oh no, I see a spider web, and it's me in the middle. So I twist and turn, but here I am in my little bubble. So
singing out. I never meant to cause you trouble. I never meant to do you wrong. And well, if I ever caused you trouble, then oh no, I never meant to do you harm. Spun a web for me. They spun a web for me. And they spun a web for me.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.